Well, this gentleman is, I think, one of the great 19th century geeks, and his name is Stanley Jevons. He's best known as an economist and as a logician, but probably mostly these days he's known for his work in economics. He's regarded as being one of the people responsible for what's called the marginalist revolution. And he's one of the people who put mathematics into economics. But my interest came from my interest in another area of interest of his, which was logic.
Yep.
I was interested in devices that I guess you could consider to be precursors to our computing devices today.
Right.
And I was looking at the area of logic, in particular Boolean logic, and I found that Stanley, as we know him, built this machine called a logic piano. Yeah, so a logic machine. And he, in the 1860s, he was working on Boolean-type logic and coming up with his own notation and his own system of logic. And he designed and built a machine that was probably the first machine capable of doing logical inference.
And Boolean logic, for those sort of unknowledgeable listeners, is the basis of computing that, as we know it.
That's, you know, right. Boolean logic describes switching circuits and computing circuits.
And the mathematics of this actually doesn't come from the 20th century. It comes from the 19th century.
That's right. And logic had always been the province of philosophers. But during the 19th century, largely, I think, on the basis of work that had previously been done by Leibniz, there was a suggestion that logic could move from a series of syllogisms, as they were usually described.
Yep.
To a more general form, you know. And the general form, it was suggested by Leibniz, could be mathematical, and I understand that George Boole...
Yes.
..took the ball and ran with it, and he set up his system of symbolic logic. Another mathematician called Augustus De Morgan was also interested in this, in using mathematics to describe logic. And they, between them, I suppose, are best known as the founders of symbolic logic. And
so, our gentleman here, how does he fit in?
Well, Jevons was... Stanley Jevons was in England and was a student of Augustus De Morgan's and came in contact with symbolic logic through De Morgan, read Boole's work, and then decided that it was fantastic, but that he could improve on it. And he also decided to build this machine. Now, I was interested in the machine, and while I was researching the machine, I discovered, to my amazement, that the same Stanley Jevons had come to Australia in the 1850s.
So there's a local Australian connection with this London-based student of
Augustus De Morgan.
Of De Morgan, yeah.
That's right. And furthermore, I found out he'd come to Australia to be an assayer at the Mint in Sydney. There was a mint set up in Sydney. It was in the 1850s. It was at the height of the gold rush. There was lots of raw gold ore around, but not much coin, and they otherwise had to ship it back to England. So they decided to set up the first branch of the mint outside of
England. So to process the raw materials and actually make valuable coin.
Yep. Yep.
Of the realm.
That's right.
And for the Queen.
And Jevons was recruited from University College as he was a chemistry undergraduate, and he was one of the top students, and he was recruited to be an assayer. And he came to Sydney, and he joined the ranks of the mint wasn't quite built, but he eventually ended up working at the mint and being an assayer at the mint. His job was to ensure the purity of the gold that went into making the sovereigns. But as part of the young crew of intellectuals at the Mint, he was very active in Sydney's intellectual life. One of the things that one of the things that he and his friends liked to do was to take photographs. They were amateur.
And this is in the 1850s, so he would have been one of the first photographers in Sydney.
There'd been photographers around in Sydney since the late 1840s. There'd been photographs being taken on a professional basis, but I suspect that this crew, Jevons and his crew at the Mint, and Sydney University had just opened up as well. I think they were some of the earliest amateur photographers.
And they would have had access to the chemicals and the processing
rooms
and that sort of stuff.
The knowledge.
Hopefully they paid for that out of their own funds and not out of the Queen's sovereign coins, but we won't go there.
They probably did. They had plenty of their own funds. They were very well-paid young men.
And so they were the geeks of their time.
They were the geeks of their time. Jevons was not only interested in photography and not only interested in, well, at the time, chemistry. He was an amateur meteorologist. He was a botanist, amateur botanist, a geologist. And indeed, before he left Sydney, he turned his scientific gaze on the city itself and did a social survey of Sydney by walking through the streets. And he ended up doing a colour-coded map, where he plotted the social status of the residents against the geography, just to see what he would get back from it.
Yeah, and this really led him into his economics in his later life.
It was part of his growing interest in economics, and he also rode on Loco Number 1, which was the first trains arrived in New South Wales almost the same year that Stanley did. He was very interested in locomotives. His father had, in fact, lost the family fortune speculating on railways in England in the 1840s, and the locomotive that's right next to this showcase, which is along here if you want to have a quick look down there.
Yep.
Well, you can only see the carriages from here, but it's the locomotives at the front. Jevons rode on that train and wrote his first papers on economics, or first his first written works on economics were letters to the local newspaper.
Looking at the economics of railways?
Yes, and denouncing the way in which it was being done.
Because his father had lost money and lost the family fortune. It's probably a little bit of an emotional connection, potentially.
I'm sure there was an emotional connection. He was also very opinionated and happy to say what he thought. And he felt...
Sounds like the geeks I know.
It found like there was a certain amount of... I think he felt that there was a certain amount of corruption going on. And the people who were running the railways and were setting it up to their own advantage. Politicians and people of influence, rather than he thought it should be a user-based system.
Yeah, and an economic model, and he had it all planned out, which is like the geeks I know, which is very much, you know, technology should be for the betterment, not understanding the political and the social until, you know, they hit it themselves.
I'm sure he felt that way.
Yeah, so let's have a look at some of the photographs that he took.
These are shots that he took of his house a house that he lived in Double Bay, which is now a very
exclusive
suburb of Sydney. Back then it was the outskirts, and particularly a house on the beach probably didn't cost that much. The houses on the hill were rather grand, the houses on the beach not so much. So young men from the Mint could afford to buy such a thing. Jevons didn't buy a house, instead he lent money to his fellow assayer, Francis Miller, and Francis Miller and his wife bought this house, and Jevons had two of the rooms. One is his bedroom and one is the study, and I'm particularly fond of this photograph of his study and his table, which he describes in detail in letters to his sister. His harmonium is in the background. He loved music, and he you might be able to hear Mozart's Requiem in the background here. He was especially fond of Mozart's Requiem. Not happy, though, with musical notation, and he wrote to his sisters about the problems, and in fact he developed his own musical notation while he was here. There's a photo of him here, which is a very sort of rough shot. It's him sitting back in a chair in his room. There are papers all over the table, and there are drawers open, and there's a telescope on the wall behind him, which caught my eye after I looked at this several times, and I often wondered about that telescope, and eventually discovered that there was a telescope in our collection here at the museum that had the word Jevons associated with it. And when I went scurrying through the files, I found this telescope here. Initially I thought it can't be the same one because it doesn't have a strap on it, but then I found the old stitching holes on its leather canister, and I'm now certain that that's the same telescope. Now, that telescope was given by Jevons to his cousin back in England sometime in the 1860s, and somehow it turned up back in Australia because it was actually purchased in Sydney in a antique shop.
So what's interesting also, Matthew, is the photograph of Jevons sitting at his desk. It reminds me of a geek's desk. You know, the books all around and the light streaming in, and he's sitting up like I would sit up. He looks like he's got his feet sitting up. He's deep in reading of some book, and that's just an amazing photograph from someone, you know.
That's right.
That far back.
And that's what he
140
did.
Years.
He sat at his desk. He compiled his... He collected data compulsively. In fact, he talked about having such a strong disposition to classify things as is sometimes painful.
And which would some would call an Asperger's or a geek-style trait.
That's right. And he collected meteorological data, botanical data. He went through his photographs. He went through his father's letters to him. Particularly after his dad died. His father died here. But classifying things was what he did best. And he would collect data and arrange it. And plotted in charts just to see what patterns were emerging. He was in some ways...
It's what we would do in Excel or something now, exactly. Over and over, if we were that sort of number-centric. Yeah.
I think that he was, you know, in some ways... Well,
a man before his time. Yeah, yeah, sadly.
And he brought graphical methods to economics and statistics that had previously not been there. So, and he drew on, in fact, practices in meteorology and took them into other fields. In fact, one of the things I've noticed is that he was very, very good at crossing disciplinary boundaries and taking ideas from one discipline and putting them into another one.
The quintessential 19th century Renaissance man, so to speak.
He was very much the polymath, but he was also a very analogical thinker. He could take an idea from somewhere and take it to where it didn't. You know, others mightn't see it fitting, but he would do so. These are more photographs of Sydney. He walked around the streets of Sydney. If you know Sydney, these are extraordinary photographs. I often challenge people who live here to tell me where they think they are, and I love watching the way they gasp when they realise what some of the photographs are. There are little hand drawings showing how he walked to work. This picture from his diary up here shows he lived in Petersham before he moved to Double Bay. You know Petersham?
Yes.
And he talked about Parramatta Road as a more disagreeable road it would be impossible to conceive.
Well, if you drive past all the car yards, it's very much the same today.
That's right.
Yeah.
But he decided then to avoid walking on Parramatta Road and instead took a bush track through the... through Leichhardt and Annandale, what we would now call Leichhardt and Annandale. And he shows his sister's...
Much more agreeable. You have more coffee shops in that particular way.
Not back then.
No.
And he shows that he walks through the bush, crosses a creek, which is probably Johnson's Creek, explains to his sisters that someone has very kindly put a series of bullock skulls in the mud so that he doesn't get his feet dirty, walks on to Glebe from where he catches the omnibus up to the Mint. And a lot of the features on there are, of course, features that those of us who live, particularly in the inner west of Sydney, know very well today.
Yes, except the coffee shop trail, as it would now be called.
That's right. I mentioned to you before that Jevons, another, I suppose, stereotypically geeky quality that he had was that he was very shy and was often uncomfortable around people.
And the opposite sex, I would assume, as well.
He was particularly awkward, it seems, from reading his letters with the local gals. He would indicate that they were showing some interest in him and then just talk about his German lessons in the next sentence as if, you know, his discussions with his sisters on this matter are revealing in that respect. But while being shy and often lonely, he confesses to his sisters, there are lots and lots of photographs that he's taken of the people that he spends time with. And we get a sense of him actually spending quite a bit of time with the people of the Mint, mainly their family and friends from the Mint. And in some ways using the camera like a foil, you know, being at these social occasions.
have a suspicion that he might be using the camera as a way of
hiding from the people and being accepted into the
hiding from direct involvement and having a purpose for being there. And some of the photographs are extraordinary. A lot of them are just portraits of his friends, but this one is actually a portrait shot taken inside the drawing room of his house. And all of his these are colleagues from the Mint and their wives, and they're sitting around a table. This is actually one half of a stereo pair. He was doing stereo photography as well. This showcase here just discusses his involvement with photography. It was a very intensive, hands-on, manual process where he made up his own plates, exposed the plates, developed the plates, fixed the plates, decided whether they were any good, and then took the pictures again. And it was just as well that he was a well-trained chemist, because that's probably what would have been required. That's what would have been required. And here is some more of the photographs that he took, some stereo photos. And this is actually one of a stereo pair. Quite often he has people posing in the attitudes of daily life, which was relatively unusual at the time. Most of the time people stood, faced the camera and held still, but he got them to pretend they were doing things. And wrote back to his sisters, he says, you know, the diggers were highly amused at being taken and only required a hint to stand in any desirable attitude so that my pictures seem almost alive with real diggers. So, regrettably, this is about his logic. And when we first opened this exhibition, Jevons' logic piano sat here, and the Museum of the History of Science in Oxford very kindly lent us the Jevons' logic machine.
And we very kindly returned it.
He did return it. And it's fantastic that they have it. And it's a beautiful machine, and it's not here. We would like to represent the machine. We have only here some of the drawings that are in that show how it was constructed. It was quite a simple machine. It was based on an idea that De Morgan gave him of a logical abacus, but he turned it into a more automatic machine. When it was on display here, we had it juxtaposed with a logic trainer from Sydney University that was designed by a friend of mine, Alan Bromley, who was a professor at Sydney University and was an authority on Charles Babbage's difference engine.
And so how does this relate to the difference engine and
Well, I always refer to the logic trainer as a latter-day logic machine or logic piano. This was one of the last logic trainers that was used at Sydney University to teach logic to computer scientists. As I understand it, they don't learn logic at this level anymore.
You'd probably be able to simulate that in software.
But quite often they don't really go to that level.
Yeah.
They don't go to the level like they did in the 1970s, 80s, into the 90s, where they had to understand how things worked at a logic level. Jevons' machine, I should say, it's worth looking at, and you can find references to
it. It's in Wikipedia,
Wikipedia. Yep. There's a picture of this showcase with it in there. It's actually like a giant automatic truth table. That's in effect what it is. And it's a beautiful machine. And he used it really as an educational instrument to demonstrate his system of logic to his students. This showcase here really is about his work as an economist. And Jevons discovered or put forward with others, you know, there was one of those cases of him simultaneously coming up with an idea with other people that he wasn't in contact with. But the idea of marginal utility. He was interested in notions of value and was aware that the value of an object, which for many years had been considered to come from the labour that went into its production, wasn't a fixed wasn't fixed at all. It was depended on how useful it was to somebody who had one of those objects, and noted that if you had one of an object, it might have a certain utility, but if you have two of them, the second one is not as valuable as the first one, and the third one is less valuable still, and in fact, if you end up with too many, they may have negative utility. So, and he used these ideas to actually set up exchange equations, and he drew on Jeremy Bentham's idea of a calculus of felicity, a calculus of happiness, if you like. Bentham, who's the founder of utilitarianism, said that people were motivated by their desire to increase their own happiness and to decrease their unhappiness, or increase their pleasure, decrease their displeasure. So Jevons thought about that arrangement and used it as the basis for his new mathematical economics, and he drew again analogically on instruments that he worked with every day at the Mint, and these were balances. And he said that if you start with a balance and you put pain in one tray and pleasure in the other tray, he was aware that certain pleasures come with attendant pains if you have too much of them, and said that people are motivated by trying to balance pleasure and pain. And then he used the physics of the lever in the balance as the basis for his exchange equations, and they were foundation mathematical equations in economics, the economics that we know today. Here's an example too of his use of graphical methods. This is actually a division of labour chart that he did in Australia, but based on data that he collected in London before he got here. This is possibly one of the first uses of graphics, if you like, in political economy.
So he obviously died relatively young?
Well, this is a picture of him here 2 years before he died, and he is in fact only 45 in that photograph. And he died partly because he maintained that habit that he developed in Sydney of going swimming. And he insisted on doing it back in England. He actually fell into poor health at this particular time in his life. And against the advice of his doctors, he was at Hastings one day and went for a swim, and he drowned while he was swimming at Hastings. And so at 47, Jevons, who was probably the greatest economist in England at the time, he died. Very remarkable. There's one quote here I should show you. And it always fascinated me. And it was lovely here next to the logic machine. And it says, it was from his journal from the 28th of May in 1866. And it says, "As I awoke in the morning, the sun was shining brightly into my room. There was a consciousness on my mind that I was the discoverer of the true logic of the future. For a few moments I felt a delight such as one can seldom hope to feel." And you can't help but think that he was imagining us in his future. I mean, I don't know how far he was imagining. But it goes on to say, "But it could not last for long. I remember only too soon how unworthy and weak an instrument I was for accomplishing so great a work, and how hardly I could expect to do it." And this quote is actually proffered by John Maynard Keynes, who wrote about Jevons and said that in the 1930s, he said that Jevons was the most important figure in economics, and the most important forefather to the people he was speaking to at the Statistical Society, and suggested that the reason that Jevons by then was relatively unknown, only some 60-odd years after his death, was that he had these moments of brilliance, but he personally retreated from them and retreated from the limelight with them.